Well, after taking some time, I think appropriately, for Memorial Day, I want us to come back now to our series on the life of Saul. Chapter-wise, we really aren't that deeply into it. So I'm just going to take a quick moment to remind you at the very outset of just the significant events that we've seen so far, because really we're only on the third of the chapters here, although we did spend a little bit of time in chapter 8. Chapter 9 makes it clear that God has chosen Saul. Back in chapter 8, we saw that the children of Israel make a big commotion. They cry out for a king. Chapter 9 makes it clear that God has chosen Saul to be this man. Okay? Then we get to chapter number 10. What key event do we see there? Well, Saul is anointed king. So this is his public time. This is when all the people understand that this is the one whom God has chosen. This, you have asked for this. Here now is what I have selected. Here's the best I can do. Here's my man. Here he is. Here's your king. So that's what happens in chapter number 10. Now, don't you notice in these stories in the Bible, which is one of the great reasons that they're so profitable to us, that they so mirror what we can find in life? And so what do you kind of think next? Here you have a new king, a freshly minted king. Not a lot of experience, but regardless of whether he had experience or not, he's not used to being a king. He's new in the job. What do you think's going to happen? Well, this is his first big test. That's what we find in 1 Samuel chapter 11. And isn't it ever that way? I mean, we come to know the Lord as our personal Savior, and God knows that the only way really to grow us is to send things our way that test our faith a little bit. And he uses that to teach us those things and to grow us and to make us more like Christ. So this is so typical of what we experience all the time, and it's what's happening here in the life of Saul. The first big test. Well, if we go, and I want you to think about a little saying, not original with me, but it certainly, I think, is applicable here. So if we go by the saying that the crisis doesn't make the man, the crisis doesn't make the man, but rather reveals the man. Heard that before? So if we go by that saying, the crisis doesn't make the man, it simply reveals the man. In other words, it brings out what's inherently there. Then things look pretty good, really, at this point with the new king. It bodes well. What we see seems to be very, very positive. However, the thing is, we know the end of the story. And we know that it changes. We know that it goes south. We know that things change drastically and actually pretty quickly from this point forward. We still have some other things, but it's not going to be very long in this before we see that things really go downhill. They change very quickly. And of course, I think a vital lesson can come to us, which is one of the things that I want to convey in the message this morning. A vital lesson that can come to us is, you know, you can have all the makings. That's the title of this morning's sermon, having the makings. He certainly had the makings. We're going to see that in the early part of this message, and we're going to see that in the early part of this chapter. He really does. He has potential. But all the potential in the world doesn't mean anything if we don't walk with God and if God doesn't bless us in our lives. All those things don't mount to a hill of beans. All the potential in the world. Beloved, I don't want to take too much time for it now because I hope to come back to it in the message later. But I would have trouble really conveying to you what a deep burden I have when I think about what I just said to you. Thinking about the years of ministry, people I have known, people who have so much potential, so much ability, so many gifts. But for whatever reason, somewhere along the way, something has happened. Some crisis just like this has come along in their lives. And all kinds of crises occur in people's lives. Sometimes it's the loss of a loved one. Sometimes it's a financial reverse. It's the loss of a job. Sometimes it's some type of a family situation, maybe with children or something like that. Some crisis comes along. And if we aren't careful to stay close to God, it really doesn't matter how much potential we have. And a lot of those people, your heart just sinks because where are they today? It's such a burden that I hope I can do a good job of trying to get this message to speak to the heart of each person who's here today. We're going to divide this into two scenes, maybe like a bit of a play, okay? Two acts, two scenes, if you want to look at it that way. We're going to have early on, and then we're going to have later on. And you kind of already know what this is going to be like, but I think that's a useful way for us to try to get a hold of this. So let's call for the curtain. It comes up on the first scene, which we're talking about early on. Things look very, very good with this new king. They really do. It's not difficult at all to understand why we get to the end of the chapter and there's joy and excitement among the people because things really look good. And I want to point you to four things I think that we can notice here, and certainly we can profit in the different lessons that can come from this, but four things about Saul that really look good. It shows the potential. It shows that he really did have the makings. And so as we look at this, the first one of these that I want to mention is he had gumption. I don't know how much we use that word now, but I like that. It's a good word, really. Gumption. What's that mean? Well, it basically just means that he had a decisiveness about him. He wasn't afraid to act. He wasn't a wallflower. He wasn't just going to be somebody who sit around and took key events that happened that he should have responded to and be afraid to act. In a leader, do you realize how important that commodity is? And do you realize how lacking we are in that today? With leadership. Saul was not that way. And where do we see this? Well, we look down in our verses, come to verse number 5. And it says, Saul came after the herd out of the field. And Saul said, what aileth the people that they weep? And they told him the tidings of the men of Jabesh-Gilead. Well, what's happened? Saul has essentially, I mean, after he's coronated king, he's anointed king, we really don't have a lot of other details other than the fact that what is implied in verse number 5 is that he sort of goes back to just kind of a normal routine of what he's used to in his life. And what is described in that, based also with what we have in chapter 9, where he went out, he was trying to find his father's donkey, so nothing really particularly amazing here when you think about the fact that Israel was a pastoral country, Israel was a country of farming, and so what do we see from Saul? He comes in out of the what? The field. And it says he's following the herd. So he seems to have largely gone back in the day-to-day affairs and routine of his life to pastoral concerns and the things that he was used to doing. He really wasn't used to being king. And so he comes in, he's following the herd, and obviously the people are upset. They've gotten this news about Jabesh-Gilead. Well, what's happened there? Well, you can read the book of the Judges, which of course is a backdrop to 1 Samuel, because Samuel was the final judge. All right, so he ends that period of time, and you can read about the back and forth between Israel and the Ammonites, Israel and the Ammonites. And without giving a lot of background, we know that they didn't get along. We know there was animosity there, not so much that Israel sought that out, but the Ammonites did. And however, though, how things seem to end in the book of Judges is that Jephthah, remember him? The judge that we have described for us there has a singular. He has quite a victory over the Ammonites. So perhaps lingering bitterness, lingering anger over the defeat that they had suffered. And there were other occasions, but this kind of seems to be the backdrop of where we are now. So they're angry over this, and Nahash comes along. He's their king, and he goes to Jabesh-Gilead. All right, let's just try to think of this for a moment, because other cities may have been known by the name of Jabesh. Why does the Bible take the trouble to call this city Jabesh-Gilead? Well, the reason it does this is so we can distinguish which Jabesh the writer has in mind. And by calling it Jabesh-Gilead, what he's telling us is okay, it's located on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Remember when the children of Israel came into the land, you had the 2.5 tribes that said, hey, this is a great place for livestock. We want to get our inheritance here. You remember this? And so Gilead was one of the places towards the northern section of the country to the east of the Jordan River. They stayed there, and Jabesh is right on the other side, right on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Well, once you get out of that territory further to the east, then you have the territory of the Ammonites. So what he did was, he just gathered his forces, he came up, he picked what he thought was a defenseless target. I mean, just think about this context for a moment, because Israel had not had a king. Israel had been very loosely organized and only seemed to have leaders when God raised up a judge. And Saul was new. He was newly minted. He was inexperienced. No one really knew how Saul might respond to an occasion. And so Nahash is emboldened. He goes up to this place and he says, hey. And they said, hey. And he says, well, the only way I'm going to let you get by with this deal is if I can thrust out your right eyes. Well, how would you react to that news? Well, the Gileadites, the people in Jabesh, didn't react too well, but they played their hand very, very well. They said, okay, well, give us a week. We'll send throughout Israel. And obviously Nahash was very cocky. He thought no one would come to their help. He said, sure, you can have a week, and nobody's going to come to your help. You're going to come out, I'll make a covenant with you, but I'm going to thrust this as a reproach. This is going to be a humiliation brought back on the nation of Israel, that here this Ammonite king came and had all the people from Jabesh Gilead come out and all their right eyes were put out. How do you like that? How do you think knowledge like that would strike our politicians today? I don't know. Only depending on the next election, I think, is how it would be decided. Saul doesn't worry too much about that. Verse number 6 says, the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard those things, and his anger was greatly kindled. So here's something you really need to observe. This is an interesting verse, because sometimes we get the impression that all anger is sinful. Not so. Not so. You have anger and you have sinful anger. Our only problem is, beloved, we have to constantly remind ourselves that because we have a fallen nature, it doesn't take us very long to cross the line between what's righteous indignation, what's just anger, and what is sinfully tinged, right? That's what you have to watch. It's not that anger's wrong. You can't come to the conclusion that all anger is wrong for a lot of reasons, but not the least of which is, this says to be produced by the Spirit of God. The Spirit of God comes upon him and his anger is greatly kindled. Well, you want to put this in every man's English? Basically what this means on the human level is, Saul hears this and he says, this can't stand. This is unacceptable. Don't you wish we had people that were decisive like that today? The man has gumption. He hears this. He says, this isn't going to stand. And he's ready to take appropriate, and he's ready to take decisive action. So he has gumption. It's a good quality for a leader to have. Leaders who just sit around and mumble and twiddle their thumbs and can't figure out what to do aren't helping us much. And it wouldn't have helped Israel much. But someone who had gumption, someone who understood and was willing to act, now that's another matter. Especially if you then determine what's right to do when you act. So he has gumption. I'll tell you something else he has. This is really interesting. He seems to have, and this is the second of the makings, he seems to have innate skill. Try to remember what I tried to show you from verse number 5. What's his background? Well, he has no experience as king. His background appears to be pastoral, right? And Israel, so far as we know, has absolutely no standing army. How do you like that? They have a new king. Now they have a military threat. The king has no experience in military matters. He's not a military man by background. And then your nation has no standing army. So what does he do? He takes a playbook, more than likely. He takes a play out of the playbook from the book of Judges. This really wasn't too terribly back in their past that this type of thing couldn't be remembered. Do you remember the story in Judges chapter 19 when the Levite's concubine was abused in that place? And what did he do? This sounds gruesome to us, and I suppose it is a bit gruesome, but I'll tell you, it sure got their attention. When that concubine was dead, he took her body and he cut her body into 12 parts. Ugh. Why 12? 12 tribes. Sent a part of that to every tribe, and I tell you what, they assembled. There was no problem getting them out. You know, it's an act of Congress now to get people out. Did you know that? I mean, you can announce that the Apostle Paul's in town. You still can't get people out. Everybody has things to do. But I'll tell you what, when that arrived on their doorstep, so what does Saul do? He has these oxen. He takes a yoke of oxen. He hews them into ever how many pieces, sends them throughout the tribes of Israel. He knows how to get people's attention. He has innate skill. He knows how to gather people. He knows how to call people to a cause. And not only that, how do you like this? Look down in verse number 11. He appears to have military skill of some kind as well, because it says, as it was so on the morrow, Saul put the people into three companies. Now, how many people does he have? He goes from zero standing army to 330,000. Now just think about that for a moment. This is already an incredible triumph because he's got these people who were disorganized, who really, there was no standing army, no generals, no defense budget. They didn't have any of this stuff. 330,000 of them fall out for this. But now you got another problem. Your success is often your problem, you know. It's like if we had 500 people here this morning, it would be wonderful, but we'd have a different problem. So he has all these people. Somebody has to organize these people. Somebody not only had to have the gumption and then the skill to figure out how to get these people to unite around him in a cause that was just, but now what are you going to do with them all? I mean, you can have mass confusion and get a bunch of people killed. So he does this. In verse number 11, we read about this. In the morning, he comes to them in the morning watch. You know, you can read books on this. And it seems to be somewhat universally agreed that about 4 o'clock in the morning is your enemy's most vulnerable time. Somehow he seems to understand that without reading the recent United States studies on this. Comes to them in the morning watch. Divides the people into 3 companies. And I mean, he just lets them have it. So he has gumption. He has innate skill. Now the next thing I want to tell you is really neat. He has meekness. What is meekness? So, well, I know the answer to that, Pastor. That's fruit of the Spirit. But you're right about that. It's a part of the fruit of the Spirit. Galatians 5 tells us love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. So what is meekness? You have a definition for meekness? A lot of people, the Greeks, right? I've told you this before. When the New Testament was written, the word that's often translated meekness for us in the New Testament really wasn't a word that had a lot of favor because it was considered not a good trait. It was kind of considered what we might call a word that rhymes with meekness. It was considered weakness. But meekness is not weakness at all. Jesus was meek. Moses was weak. I don't think anybody would confuse either of the two of them with someone who was weak. Meekness is controlled strength. That's why it's a fruit of the Spirit, because see, here you have somebody who possesses the types of gifts that Saul does. A man who is decisive, capable of being decisive, has gumption, capable of a righteous response and indignation, ready to do something about it as God leads, organizes his people, and then executes a successful military campaign. Well, you get that kind of a person, that's a lot of strength. That strength has to stand under control. Or otherwise, like I said, the anger can sometimes be tinged by our sinful nature, and then we've done something that isn't good. We cross a line. What happens in this case? Where do you see meekness? Well, you get to the end of the chapter, look at this. The people, when they see this tremendous victory, they remember what was said back at the end of chapter 10. All right? Verse 26, Saul also went home to Gibeah, and there went with him a band of men whose hearts God had touched, but the children of Belial said, how shall this man save us? And they despised him and brought him no presents. But it says he held his peace. Right there already there was an indication of this. But now look at verse 12 of the chapter that we're in. The people said unto Samuel, who is he that said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring them in that we may put them to death. And Saul says, just say no to revenge. That's hard to do, you know. Especially now he has everybody on his side. I mean, he had political capital in spades. He could have gotten anything he wanted. Why not get rid of the people who were his detractors? What an opportunity. Just get rid of these people who were these sons of Belial, who said these things about him, who criticized him, and in the beginning he had the strength to just hold his peace. But he says in verse 13, Saul said, there shall not a man be put to death this day, for today the Lord hath wrought salvation in Israel. Wow. The man has some interesting and positive qualities. There was a missionary one time who was teaching a Sunday school class, and he was talking about this very thing. He asked the students, what is meekness? So they were talking about Matthew chapter 5, where Jesus mentions this in the Beatitudes. And the missionary asked the students in the class, well, what is meekness? And there was a little boy who said this. He said, meekness is when you can answer a rough question softly. Not bad, huh? Strength under control. It's when you can answer a rough question softly. And Saul is able to do that. So we've got three things that really look good. They bode well. He has the makings. I'm going to tell you something. The last one that I'm going to give you is the most important of all. Because you can take the first three, and as good as they are, if you don't have the last one that I'm going to mention to you, again, it doesn't really matter. He has the blessing of God. How do you tell this? Well, you just look back to verse 6, all these things that have happened so far, God is really responsible for them. Who is the one who infuses him with the gumption? Well, according to verse 6, the Spirit of God came upon Saul. If you go back to chapter 10 and verse 10, it was the Spirit of God. Verse 10 of chapter 10, it says, when they came hither to the hill, behold, a company of prophets met him, and Saul, the Spirit of God came upon him, and he prophesied among them. And God changed Saul and came upon him by the power of his Spirit from that time forward. Wow. The Spirit of God was the one who infused him with this gumption. The Spirit of God, the one who gave him this skill that he had no training, no preparation for. Do you remember when they built the tabernacle? And they had need of all those things. Well, who was going to make them? Who was going to make the candelabra? Who was going to make the altar? Who was going to make those things that had to be crafted and the metallurgy skills and all those things that were required to take that gold and make the cherubim and all those different things? Who was going to do that? And God raised up two people by the name of, well, one of them was Aholiab and the other Bezalel. And you can look at it in Exodus chapter 36 and verse 1. It says the Lord was the one who gave them that skill, that wisdom. Sometimes in the Old Testament, wisdom is a very practical term. Maybe even a little more practical. We tend to think of wisdom in the abstract. The Bible tends to think of it as very practical. How are you going to make something? How are you going to get something done? You need wisdom. God gave it. And who is the one who brings this meekness to him? Well, he's under God's control. See, he has God's blessing resting upon his life. It's God. Thinking back to crusade times, the times of the crusaders, there's an interesting story about Saladin. Now, that's not something that Pastor Adam was asking for the ladies. They needed Saladins and desserts, right? And if you have any leftover Saladins, Pastor Adam asks for them. That's not what that is. Saladin was actually the first sultan. So you think back to what was going on in the crusades, and you had the Christians, those that professed Christianity, and you had them trying to roll back that great Islamic tide. See, there's something that's not totally new about everything that we're dealing with. And they were trying to roll that back, and so Saladin was the first of the Islamic sultans. He had control over the Syria region, and he had control over Egypt. And on one occasion, Richard the Lionhearted was there, and he had the opportunity, the Englishman, Richard the Lionhearted, and he had the opportunity to see the sword of Richard. And he looked at that sword, and he made some remark to the effect, he just was amazed. How in the world could such great feats have been wrought with what appeared to be such an ordinary instrument? And Richard bared his arm and held it up and said, it was not the sword that wrought these things, it was the arm of Richard. I'll tell you something, beloved, always well to remember, it isn't our arm, it's God. You can have all those gifts, you can be brimming with all those potentialities, you can have all that going for you. But if you don't have God, and that's where we have to let the curtain close on scene number one and ask the curtain to rise on scene number two. Because scene one was early on, scene two is later on. What happens later on? Well, I already told you, it doesn't take very long for all this to really go downhill in a hurry. And it's really sort of sad when you see these things. We're going to just take a few minutes, just as quickly as I can do this for you, to try to point out some of these things that we've just now talked about and see what happened with them. Because, first of all, we saw that he had gumption. He had this, but what we're looking at now is, it didn't take very long, this anger that we saw mentioned there, it didn't take very long for that to become uncontrolled. So we're not going to go out of 1 Samuel, but I'm going to ask you to put your bullets in here so you can get back to it and just limber up just a bit. We're going to move around a few pages close to where we are because I want you to see these things. Turn to chapter 20 and verse 30. See, this is the same thing I'm talking about, this anger, and it can slip away awfully quickly. And the first thing you know, and boy, it doesn't take very long for it to become uncontrolled in his life. Look at verse 30 of chapter 20. Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. Who's Jonathan? His son. His most prominent son. His anger was kindled against him, Jonathan. And he said unto him, "Thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman, do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion and unto the confusion of thy mother's nakedness?" Now, let me just tell you what's in this verse without being overly explicit. He gets angry. He loses control. He calls his own son what our modern equivalent of an SOB is. Excuse me for being explicit, but that's what this is. That's what he does. I think you're out of control when you do something like that. And he was out of control. It didn't take very long, see, for this to happen. And then we look at some of these other things that we were pondering and rejoicing in. And so the gumption. What about the skill? Well, it didn't take very long for him to take that skill and turn that to be used for himself. Where do we see this? Well, chapter 15. So go back to chapter 15 for a moment. God sends him out on a mission, remember, to take care of the Amalekites. Now, God has given him some of this skill for military success. What does he do with it? Well, we read in verse number 9, just have a look at this. It says, "But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and of the oxen and of the fatlings and of the lambs and all that was very good and would not utterly destroy them, but everything that was vile and refuse, that they destroyed utterly." Well, I think we're familiar enough with the story to know that God had told them to destroy everything. So why did they save Agag, who was the Amalekite king? And why did they? Well, Saul's justification was to do sacrifice. But when you read down here a little bit further, have a look at this, verse 17. Well, let's look a little bit more here. 12 I really wanted us to see. "And when Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning, it was told Samuel, saying, Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set him up a place, and is gone about, and passed on, and gone down to Gilgal." Now, see, in our version, you look at that and you're not quite sure what it's talking about, right? It just says that he set him up a place. Till you look into this a little bit more carefully, and place is the idea of a monument. Oh. So he has a victory over the Amalekites that God gives him. He's disobedient in that. And instead of giving God the glory, he's more concerned about going and erecting a monument to himself. Samuel hits the nail right on the head. It says here in verse 17, "Samuel said, When thou wast little in thine own sight, wast thou not made head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed thee over Israel?" It doesn't take very long for him to turn vindictive. This is another thing for us to notice. What about his own son? He tries to kill him. What about David? He tries to kill him repeatedly, in fact. Look at chapter 14 of Samuel. And look at verse 29. "Then said Jonathan, My father hath troubled the land, See, I pray you, how mine eyes have been enlightened because I have tasted a little of this honey. So then we get down to verse 44, and it says, and Saul answered, God do so, and more also, for thou shalt surely die, Jonathan. Why? What in the world is going on here? He turns mean and he turns vindictive, if for only the reason that he's been humiliated. He gives this silly order in the battle with the Philistines that it is about the Philistines back in this chapter. He gives this silly order that no one is to eat anything all day long. The troops become weakened, as you can only imagine. The victory is curtailed that much more. Jonathan is not there to hear that. And so Jonathan dips his spear, takes some honey. Immediately he receives strength. His eyes are lightened, the Bible says. And he realizes that his father has become very foolish and done a very foolish thing. And when Saul finds out about this, he's enraged. I mean, it doesn't take not only long to see this anger become uncontrolled, but it doesn't take very long to see it become mean and vindictive to the point that he's ready to kill his son, if only that he feels humiliated. And what about David? Why does he turn on David? Well, again, let's look at some verses on this. And we need now to go to chapter 18. Let me be sure I've got that verse correct for you. Yes, chapter 18, verse 7. Have a look. Don't you love this one? And the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul hath slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. That didn't set too well with Saul. Look at the next verse. Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him. And he said, they have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and unto me they have ascribed but thousands. And what more can he have but the kingdom? And look at this telling phrase at the end of verse 9. And Saul eyed David from that day forward. And it's not very much later in the chapter that we read that Saul tries to kill him. Verse 11, Saul cast the javelin, for he said, I will smite David even to the wall. And David avoided out of his presence twice. I'm just giving you one example. He tried to kill David on a lot of occasions. Folks, what happened to his meekness? Do you see the picture that I'm trying to portray for us here? What happened to this man? This man who had gumption, but it didn't take very long for that anger to become controlled. This man who had skill, but it didn't take very long for him to turn the skill to use for his own glory and not God's. This man who had meekness, but it didn't take very long for him, humiliated by his son, to threaten to kill him, or for him to be jealous of David and attempt to kill him on multiple occasions. And one last thing. We talked about the fact that the most important thing was the blessing of God. Just look quickly back at chapter 15. He loses that. Now you're really in trouble. You're really in desperate trouble when this happens. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 26, Samuel said unto Saul, I will not return with thee, for thou hast rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord hath rejected thee from being king over Israel. Oh my, folks, doesn't this just break your heart? I mean, when you look at this man who had the makings, this man who had such potential, this man who could have truly been a wonderful servant to the people of Israel and a wonderful king, why is this so? What has happened to him? He's not careful about his walk. And what doth the Lord require of thee? He has showed thee, O man, what is good. And what doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly and to love mercy and to, you know the next one? Walk humbly with thy God. You see, the crisis doesn't make the man, the crisis reveals the man. And this is the thing that ought to scare the liver out of every one of us here this morning, because see, it doesn't just usually happen in a big fell swoop. It's usually an incremental kind of thing. Somewhere along the line, something happens. Often it is some type of a crisis. Often it is some type of a problem that enters into our lives. and somehow we get bumped off the way of walking with God. We listen to ourselves. Our anger over something crosses the line from being that which might have some legitimacy to it to being tinged with our own carnality. Left to brood there and to generate there, it can degenerate into that which is vindictive and mean and uncontrolled. And while the things that we see in the life of Saul may not be exactly the things that are in the lives of other people to whom this happens and over whom sometimes we see and grieve, the lesson's really pretty clear. And I want to just bring it to a head by asking you to think with me about two people. In the New Testament, you have a man by the name of Demas. Interesting. You don't have to turn, but I'm going to read you a couple of verses. Now, the first one comes from the book of Colossians. I think you know the name Demas, right? And unfortunately, it's famous to us for the wrong reason. But Colossians was a prison epistle, right? And so I want you to see this as I read this verse, because I want you to see where this falls in the life of Paul. It's in his first Roman captivity, and in Colossians 4 and verse 14, it says, Luke, we know Luke, the beloved physician, and Demas greet you. So he's with Paul, has been with Paul. He's there on a plane with Luke. And he sends greetings to the church at Colossae. Then we go to the book of Philemon, and we kind of have to move a few more pages to get to that because it comes up after 2 Timothy, but you go to the book of Philemon, and there we look at verse 24. Similar. Marcus, we know Mark, right? Aristarchus, Demas, Lucas, there's Luke again. My fellow laborers. They all salute. They all send their greetings. All right, what happens? What happens between that first Roman captivity when you have a man who is in the company of Paul's most intimate circle and close friends, who's trusted, who's serving the Lord, who has the potential to be a great blessing to the church, and you get to 2 Timothy chapter 10, and you read something. Here's what it is. For Demas hath forsaken me, having loved this present world, and is departed unto Thessalonica. What happened? We don't read of a crisis. Might have been. We don't read of a crisis. Just somehow, slowly, incrementally, the things of the world versus the sacrifice that was involved in the service of Christ, the things of the world became more appealing, and little by little, that's how it works, you know, with worldliness. I'm talking to Calvary Independent Baptist Church. I'm not worried about the guy next door. He's got his own problems. I'm talking about here. That's how it works, you know. Just an incremental thing. We make a little concession here. Oh, nothing wrong with that. Make a little concession. Oh, nothing wrong with that. First thing you know, you develop a taste for those things. And the first thing you know, it's out of control. It's like a lot of things. It's a very potent, potent force. And a man who had potential, a man who had talent, a man who was on his way to being enshrined with the most intimate of Paul's friends and successors and helpers. All we remember about him now is, Demas hath forsaken me, having loved this present world. The other, we won't even bother to look because the verse is only one and most people know it. That's Genesis 5 and verse 24. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. What kind of days did Enoch live in? Easy days? Well, I think we probably feel a little bit sorry for ourselves and figure that we have it rough right now, but I don't think it was as bad as when Enoch was living. And I just wanted you to hear a little piece of poetry about this little phrase in the life of Enoch, because he was careful about his walk. So listen. He walked with God, Could grander words be written? Not much of what he thought or said is told. Not where or what he wrought is even mentioned. He walked with God. Brief words of fadeless gold. How many souls were succored on his journey, helped by his words or prayers? We may not know. Still, this we read, words of excelling grandeur. He walked with God while yet he walked below. And after years, long years, of such blessed walking, one day he walked, then was not. God said, come. Come from the scene of weary, sin-stained sadness, and come to the fuller fellowship of home. Such be the tribute of thy pilgrim journey. When life's last mile thy feet have bravely trod, when thou hast gone to all that there awaits thee, this simple epitaph, he walked with God. Did you ever think about that? I'm not dropping hints because, believe me, I'm just not. But can you imagine that? If somebody couldn't figure out what else to write on your tombstone, he walked with God. In that chapter, that great obituary of the Bible, he died, he died, he died. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. What an epitaph. He walked with God. Little story quickly, and we'll be done. What I've been trying to emphasize this whole morning, and I want to use this to try to emblazon it in our minds. See, all the makings and all the potential are no good if we don't understand that ours is the responsibility to use them for God and to be careful about our walk. Because the crises are going to come. The temptations are going to come. And you can have all that. And 5 years from now, not be here in a pew at this church and maybe not even be recognizable as a Christian to the people around you. Happens all the time. Sad. Really sad. Can it happen to me? Yes. Can it happen to you? Yes. Therefore, the whole point of the message is, got to be careful about your walk. Because it happened to Saul. In World War II, the Germans built lots of airplanes. And Messerschmitt to Germany was kind of like Boeing is to America. And so the Messerschmitt bombers were an incredibly effective tool in the hand of the German Luftwaffe. But I'm going to tell you a story about a Messerschmitt plane this morning that you've never heard of. I'll lay dollars to donuts. I don't have either, so we're safe. That you haven't ever heard this before. The Messerschmitt 323. You know what it was? It was a glider, a troop glider. It had one sole mission when it was developed. It was towed, as gliders are, and it ferried troops, large, large, large quantities of troops. The Germans built 200 of them to use over Russia. The only problem was it didn't take very long for the Germans to figure out, you know, it's a one-shot deal. You take this thing, you pull it up in the air, it's flying. It has all these troops in it. You let it loose. It lands, hopefully safely, and it's accomplished its mission, but you built this airplane. What's so remarkable about this thing is the Germans called it Gigant. You can figure what that word means? Same as our English, gigantic. It had a wingspan almost as big as a Boeing 747. It was the largest single airplane of that time built or used in World War II. The Germans were engineers. They built 200 of them and figured out, you know, one-shot deal. So they decided that they would equip it with engines. When you see pictures of the Messerschmitt 323, the ones with engines, it's really interesting to look at. This huge airplane, wheels underneath like crazy to land the thing. But on each wing now, they built 200 more. Three engines. Three engines on the port, three engines on the starboard. They used it again over Russia, and they used it over North Africa, but by 1944, every single one of them was shot down. Why? It had a lot of potential. It also now had another glaring weakness. It was defenseless. They were all shot down. And beloved, I want to tell you something. Just think about that and think about Saul and apply it to yourself. You can be gigant. You can be an engineering marvel. You can have talents and potentials that just oodle and oodle and oodle all over the place. But if you don't walk with God, the fatal flaws that all of us have because of our sinful nature, all of us have them. All of a sudden, those things can eclipse all of that. And the Messerschmitt 323 today, no one knows about it except for people that are really buffs of World War II history. It's forgotten. They were all shot down. All I want to say to you this morning as we close is, I don't care to go down in flames like that. But it happens all the time. Happens to friends. Happens to people you love. Happens to people you know. They aren't careful about their walk with God. Something comes along, and now you don't see them. Father, I pray that you would watch over us and guard us because we realize, Lord, in many ways how vulnerable we are. Vessels of clay, that's all we are. And the Bible reminds us over and over again, we have this treasure in earthen vessels that the excellency of the glory might be of God and not of us. And so if the story this morning of Saul leaves us with a bit of a scare, perhaps it should. Perhaps it should cause us to realize by negative example what happens to people who aren't careful with their walk. Because when the crises come, then the value of our walk with God really shows. The times that we've spent reading the Bible, the times that we've spent praying, the times that we've spent listening and absorbing your truth, they're there for us. They guide us. They keep us on the pathway. They're used by the Holy Spirit to convict us when in our flesh we would depart. So I pray that you'll watch over me. Pray that you'll watch over others. Pray that if we have anybody here this morning that realizes that maybe there's just been a creeping carelessness in his walk, pray that you'll just touch our hearts and help us to be willing to recognize that, to be honest with you about it, and take whatever steps we need to take to be careful that each day we're not forgetting the fundamental foundational things of what makes the Christian life work. Our heads are bowed, our eyes are closed. You here today and know the Lord as your personal Savior. And every one of us could respond to a message like this. I understand that. I'm more interested in if the Lord has spoken to you in some special sense, just the sense in which you say, you know, I don't want to be like Saul. That's a general sense, but the specific sense of, you know, Pastor, there's just some carelessness. I see it. I need to get a hold of this before I let my Christian life become weakened to the point and I hit with some crisis and I don't respond properly and I'm gone. Anybody here this morning, you say, Pastor, I'm concerned about a little creeping carelessness in my Christian walk. Pray for me. I need to get that squared away. I need to get back to the old landmarks. Anybody here, just raise your hand. Let me include you in the prayer. I'm not going to embarrass you. Anybody? Anybody here this morning, say, Pastor, I'm not sure I'm saved. Would you pray for me? I need to get this settled. Anybody, just slip your hand up. Our Father, we thank you for allowing us the privilege of spending time together in God's house this morning. I pray you'll bless those things that have been from you and that we needed to hear, and anything that may not have been from you, just let that fall to the ground, perish from our memories. But those things that truly were from you that we needed to hear, help us to store those up, use them in our hearts and lives, for Christ's sake. Amen.